Yeah, I've saved you a...
It wasn't really a question, it says ventriloquizing objects.
3264.
So maybe I should start and then see how we go, maybe we can all migrate elsewhere. I guess one of the things, I'll read down what I've written. It was this thing about ventriloquism, and how do we distinguish between hearing objects speak and ventriloquizing on their behalf? Because when Gabriel was doing his talk, it felt like a lot of it was ventriloquizing what the objects were saying. And so I was thinking about that. And then I thought, well, actually, what if ventriloquism was the voice of the object? That there was something very peculiar about ventriloquism, which was actually the language through which objects speak. And then I was thinking, oh, well, actually, rather than the person, but then we come back to this agency thing that's been going on all along. In the act of ventriloquism, is it really the object that actually is speaking, and the person becomes the medium in that sense? So is it the human that is ventriloquized by the object? Yeah. So there's something about that I was thinking about.
I'm struggling to split the two apart. Like, what's the difference? And can you break it down into like a formula so that we can like what actually can they?
No, split? I mean I suppose that's the thing with these things is that you sort of propose something. Yeah. Jasper actually got very coherent understanding of what he was trying to work with. That's the limit of my sense of understanding what that would be. I think some of it's to do with this kind of this sense of what the place that the human has. As the authority or the agent, I guess we'll come back to that. And what might it mean to be, might it mean to be ventriloquized?
That word alone, it's almost like immediately thinking sort of puppetry and almost like I'm being fooled or it's not truth.
Yeah.
It's like another voice that's operating behind the scenes. So is. Again, it's like wrapped up in language, isn't it, with the idea of ventriloquism.
I think it was more this reversibility that I was interested in. Yeah. Actually, in the last talk, this is on a bit of a tangent, I was thinking a lot about, do you know Roger Calloir's writing? There's a really famous text that he wrote in the 20s called something about legendary psychasthenia, and he talks about the way that insects mimic twigs. So the way that an animate object might mimic an inanimate object. And I've been thinking a lot about that, actually. He talks about it being possessed. He talks about, rather than it being a survival strategy, the insect mimics the twig, not to survive, but because it's seduced by the call of the twig. It's like a convulsion in a way. He talks about it in terms of the insect possessed by the twig.
These properties that.
And I kind of wondered something about that, that it must be, whether it must be.
Okay. So it's almost like a representation or, I'm being crude, but a photocopy of an object to represent that in a new form or.
I think this sort of the thing that I'm really interested in the proposition today is the sense of the speaking of the object, and thinking around that. So in the one earlier, I was sort of interested in the idea of the object's potential muteness or its potential silence or its resistance. And this again, it's just that sense of.
Of course, that changes, doesn't it? When if you set up a proposition of objects.
Yeah.
That. So if you,
Is there something called something stone? I think it's soap stone. I don't know what it's something stone. And there's, I think it's, I'm getting this story wrong, but there's a rock, and I think it's the Buddhists, and they go and they collect the rock, and they find one that looks like someone, and then they will meditate on the properties that rock looks like.
Wow.
So I guess it's kind of this, because I always think of kind of rock, what is a rock? Kind of rocks. Yeah. That's sort of like the age I was. I'm sure there's lots of myths and fairy tales about rocks speaking. It's just really interesting that if you had this rock and it kind of, if it didn't resemble anything, would it still speak? But then if it had like a tree, it kind of looked like a face or whatever, would you be able to have dialogue?
Because this guy Kawa, I went to a conference once about him, and there was a whole lot of the discussion about rocks, and I really can't remember what the content was, but I'm going to have to go back because there's something about him, his understanding of the rocks having some kind of life force. So yeah, there's just something there that, in his work in particular, I think there might be something. Yeah.
Maybe rocks are the least animated object you can have, and so it's just a great thing to use as an example of bringing life into this thing that's just dead.
Through the Nordic sagas, there are rocks, but it seems like so many civilizations have that association with the rocks, you say.
So, I mean, in some ways, I think this kind of question relates a bit to the thing that Julie was talking about in the sense of possession and spirit. Or that, again, that reversibility of possession, that you can possess an object but also be possessed by it. And I think that's, you know, I guess it's central to a lot of surrealist ideas in some respects that I think André Breton talks about it a lot in relation to the way that the surrealists would identify the found object. I think he talks about it in terms of you don't find the found object, it finds you. And I quite like that sense there. But again, I'm not sure whether that brings it into the realm of glorifying the object and giving it human qualities like agency and choice.
Though, I think he tried not to when, like before in the last discussion, we were trying to break it down so much that we like human and that's the way tangible things to talk about something in. How do you make those relationships between objects, things, and us without doing that? It's
we touched on that as well in that objectifying belief and making it solid so that you can touch it. It reminds me of crystals and feeding crystals, and then they have their own properties and you move them on.
Yeah.
But I kind of wonder sometimes whether that sense of the emphasis on keeping the object relatively stable is because of that sense of the subject position has been so. It's not that it's so ever present, it's that it's always on the point of collapse.
What do you mean?
That as a notion that, as a, that we're always. I don't know whether we're always at the point of our subjecthood fitting into objecthood in some kind of way. I mean, that in a weird kind of way, that's what mortality is in some respects, isn't it, I guess? That there's this sort of, that as a human, the sense of becoming inanimate is right at the heart of our experience of being alive in a way.
Okay.
And the threat of objecthood is one of death, I don't know. But it's huge, yeah. It feels as if that sense of defining ourselves as not object is a weird kind of stalling of death in a way, I don't know.
It's almost a threat. It's a constant.
Yeah. I don't know. There's probably, like, if you're a psychoanalytic person, there's probably a whole way of really thinking about that in those terms, which I'm not.
It was. In the last one of the discussions I was in, somebody was talking about the father dying and these objects that were around the house, and how they found it difficult to know which things to throw away and what to keep. And then as time progresses, the point when you think, actually, I can get rid of this thing. So it's almost, that's almost like serve a purpose, or whatever that is, it's served like it's life span, yes, and then it goes on to something else and changes again.
Yeah. Also, I sort of think that thing about the death thing and the way that you might think about it in terms of continuity and discontinuity from the things that I'm not sure whether that sense of understanding, a sense of your discreteness from other things. Gabriel was talking earlier about that sense of in the absence of humans, do objects consider themselves separate from each other? Is it only through language that an object gets its distinctiveness or its edge?
Mm.
Again, that's.
I couldn't really grasp the concept just because he was so. It wasn't even abstract because that's a thing. It was like proto object, it was almost antimatter.
Mm.
It was. Yeah. I couldn't physically, even mentally get the concept, so I was sort of lost.
But the thing with the Kiowa thing again is this thing between the stick insect and the twig is that it's the collapse of the edge that delimits self from non-self, or insect from twig. I think that there's something to do with the need to preserve a certain kind of edge, otherwise psychologically it's just. it's, well, he talked about it, or no, maybe it talked about in sort of certain schizophrenic senses that you...
Okay, so if you lost self-awareness, but yeah, if you were schizophrenic or something and you weren't self-aware or...
Yeah, yeah, so the kind of the pathology is linked to it, in the sense of, you know, whether it's the object speaking through you is a kind of pathology, or whether that's a kind of the sense of oneself collapsing into object, which again might be thought of. There's a whole set of risks attached to that sense of, which we're talking about in the other discussion of, like, well, how is it possible for the human to be more object?
Sorry. When we were talking earlier, we keep having in the conversation I had earlier, someone was talking about you're psychotic, then you don't know that you consider yourself an object, but you have to touch the stool, and you know the stool is an object, you touch yourself, and you are an object.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's like when people say, oh, if you're dreaming something, pinch yourself, and then you're not dreaming that.
Because Carl was talking about the insect's behaviour as being a psychotic quality. Yeah, that it's not a survival strategy, it's psychosis, which again I think is quite interesting. We went off subject a bit, and I was talking about a text by, Shapailwar, called Legend of a Psychasthenia, where he talks about the stick insect as this kind of, he talks about animal mimicry quite a lot, and the point where an animate animal of some sort of attempts to become inanimate, or pretends that it's a twig.
Oh, right, yeah.
I'm not doing because I don't know why we got onto that.
I think it's because I'm tired, actually. Although I'm convening this, but I've lost the will on the ventriloquism. Have you got particular things on the ventriloquism that you were wanting to bring?
You mean why? Yes, that's true, because I chose to be here. Well, I suppose I was interested in this idea of... I mean, yeah, what brings me here is how we give meaning to objects. So that's why the notion of ventriloquizing objects interested me, because it's as if we give voice to inanimate things. And how we, each of us does it ourselves, but also how we might be wanting to encourage other people to do that. You know, there's a great sort of like bring an object and tell me about yourself kind of strategy.
Okay.
Which I've certainly used when I run workshops as an introduction, and it's very powerful, in fact.
Yeah.
Because people will often tell you very deep and wonderful things, just in this sort of like, bring an object to represent yourself as a brief, can often lead to exquisite narratives. So I'm interested in how we do that.
What I was curious about was
that we as human beings do that.
Would be that moment of whether the object was ventriloquizing the person in that instance, which I find quite interesting in the sense of those moments when the object almost allows a depth that wouldn't be spoken otherwise to be articulated.
Very much. Certainly, that's what I've been using it for and as.
It's interesting. It sounds almost, gosh, I'm just going back to degree days now, my third year, what's going on. And part of my project, I guess, was I had this idea that, how can I even describe this? Okay, so I came up with this story that there was a factory somewhere and they were creating objects, and then one day they had this creative director guy or some facilitator person come in and just show them different ways of working, you know, just say, oh, let's go outside today and we'll work in the park, or little things, just something like that. And eventually the story goes on and on, and basically change the way they work, you know, they become more freer, I guess, and more independent, and to shake up ideas. And then when he leaves, he gives them an object, this thing, and I call it like a proto-object, because it's not an object, it's a physical representation of everything they've been through. You know, this is what we've done together, this is to remember it, and this is what meaning and form, and you know, this is what, and there you go, and do what you want, pass it on. And so yeah, I don't know, you know, where that goes or whatever.
But I think the art object's really weird as well, because in terms of the art object having the capacity to ventriloquise, I think that through the encounter with an art object, I think as humans it can produce the vocabulary or a sense of ideas that you didn't have before. So in a sense, is that coming from the objects?
It's this idea of romanticism as well, when you see, well, I haven't had it myself, but I've had a couple of things. If you see a piece of work, you think, oh, I really want to see that work. And then there's that moment of, oh, wow, that's that intangible thing, that quality, that, what is that? That, ooh, that's done something.
Yeah, is that the message of the artist?
Oh, yeah, you know, or is it the object?
It's a weird thing, the art object, because it's that kind of sort of a hybrid of the
material. And I don't know many other objects or things that do that.
Is it also because we've gone somewhere to see something? I mean, are we giving it value because of the action and we know it's an art object? So is it giving us the space to do that in, that we don't give ourselves otherwise? I wonder.
I just want to go there.
No, I love that space. Yeah. I think that's why I do go there.
But is that the architecture of that space, then, of the actual objects encountered within it?
I think it's the ritual. You know, you get out the list of galleries and you schlep there, and you know it's a space, and you know someone's thought about it and spent a lot of time, and you know they've invested a lot of energy. Well, it may be idea, it may not be craft, but it's someone has put energy and time into it, which may be manifest in its physicality or maybe manifest in its idea or whatever. I mean, I'm not going to say whichever kind, but I suppose what I'm saying is I think we're engaging in a ritual. Some don't work, you know, you might schlep around five galleries and only one's any good, but that's fine too.
In my personal experience, all of those, when it does romanticise moments, thinking of what you're thinking of, there's maybe a few moments, or in fact other experiences that have really changed something inside me, or so I feel. Those, especially the ones that to do with art, have happened when it's not an expression that I plan to see.
Yeah.
I remember first one was going to see the Turner Prize nominees 12 years ago, and friends saying, oh, look at this, it's really great. I went and thought, I'm staying here. So I stayed in the room, and then just something shifted, and I was just like, I literally don't want to leave.
What was the word?
I'm just trying to remember. It's Michael Rydecker.
But it's interesting in that moment of transformation.
Yeah.
Is that the moment where you can hear is that the moment of hearing the object speak? Yeah. You know, in the sense of sometimes when there are those transformations, I think particularly with art encounters, it feels like it opens up unlocks the possibility of thinking in a different way or having an idea in a different way to what you thought. Mm. Is that something that's been almost like provoked from within? Or is that coming?
Maybe
is that
are
you hearing that?
Maybe,
you already know it, but you just needed something? And I would say no. Actually, I think sometimes I don't know. Does it say something? Is it saying something?
Well, like you say, is it actually that sort of subliminal ritual and that's being engineered by somebody who knows stuff that you don't know? I would like to think that it's that little click that happens in your brain when something connects with something else, and you start to think differently about something, and it allows something to flow where it's not flowed before.
Because just in terms of like vernacular, you sort of talk about objects speaking to you, or you know, a piece of work spoke to me in a particular way. But again, that's like not using it's not using language in that sense. It's a particular kind of, you know, in a transformative sense that something speaks to you. It had that kind of effect. I'm just curious in terms of can we think of that actually as the objects actually speaking?
Can it?
Can you take that and bottle it and put it in other things as well? Now, just a little bit, I think about sort of zenness and crafting of objects or doing something in the simplest way possible. And let's, for example, have like tea. I'm going to have tea in the most perfect way that I can possibly have tea, and there's something about this pot or whatever, or, you know, like a purity, or I'm not quite sure where I'm going, but I'm just thinking about a purity and an object speaking in the most purest way, I guess. Is that again just been true?
I would like to, I suppose part of the reason for sort of asking questions. I don't know much. I'd like to know more about Ventral Prison. And I think about some of those shows recently that have been specifically dealing with ideas around the Henry Moore Institute quite a few years ago. I don't really know. I don't really know enough about it as an area, really. So,
which shows do you mean?
There was an exhibition at Henry Moore Institute probably about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe even more. It was to do with ventriloquism specifically. Or the kind of the placing of a voice within a sculpture of some sort.
You mean literally?
I think it was both literally and not, actually. I think it was interrogating the limits of what we might mean by ventriloquism. Because I guess in asking the question, I'm not even sure what I mean by ventriloquism.
Yeah.
Like it has that connotation of a dummy in the puppet.
Well, I mean, Tony Osmond's work at one level is literally doing that.
Yeah, his work was in the show.
Yeah. That's why I was asking whether it was literal or metaphorical.
Yeah.
Because what we're talking about much more is the metaphorical relationship, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But obviously someone like his practice and Laurie Anderson's practice too, he literally does that.
Yeah.
In a wonderfully powerful way, I think, I must say. But
that very much is the artist ventriloquizing the object, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is not the same as what does the object speak?
Completely different, yeah.
Nor is it the same as what might it mean for the human to be ventriloquized.
Is it different from, say for example, I can't express something, but I know if I make an object that's going to express a much clearer idea of what I want to say, is that
it's finding another way of speaking, I suppose, isn't it? Which is very interesting. I think you're right. I think for some people that is how they communicate in the world. I mean, they find it a more powerful way because language lets us down endlessly.
But also in making work, sometimes I don't know whether you're an artist or not, or what you know. But sometimes whether it's in making something. Sometimes it's really hard to know whether it's or who's making it, in the sense that the materials have got it makes itself a bit sometimes, and that sense of as an object comes into being. I think it's only through the intentions of the artist that happens. I think there's a sense of resistance or force or something that the materials themselves do, whether that's writing or other forms. I think.
I think materials exert, you go against the grain, it doesn't work. I mean, there's certain things you discover don't work, so you can't inflict your desire or whatever on some materials, you have to work with them. Whether that means they determine the outcome, or whether it's some kind of bizarre collaboration between oneself and the material, I would tend to argue that, perhaps. Because you have to work within the limits of the material. You can't just, I'm going to do... because you just might not do it.
Yeah.
It might just not be physically possible
but
with that material.
That's kind of trying to make the material do something it doesn't want to do.
That's what I mean. So you can't do that.
The material wants to do something.
Yeah. So you have to do that.
Those moments.
Yeah.
All the time. But then those often are by far the most interesting.
But then you're sort of going with the flow of the material, aren't you? You're almost letting it happen.
Yeah, you're sort of at its mercy.
Yeah, and you're putting a trust in that, aren't
you,
as well?
Yeah, you have to.
But in a way, it's a less arrogant position to take up, isn't it?
Having that relationship to material.
I mean, it sounds good. It sounds, you know, because I'm going to do this with it. It's like, no, sorry.
It's quite liberating.
Yeah. Don't do that.
But actually, really attending to that kind of experience is not. It's not a common experience, is it? I don't think. In terms of, I would guess that many people's relationships to objects and material isn't of that understanding, because in most instances
most people don't make anything.
You don't make anything.
Nobody makes anymore.
So there's a peculiar kind of sensitivity to that.
Although we're always striving for better things, we're constantly making gripes about. Work or having trouble with this or
not
working in computer. There's always going to be progression, but then there is that thing about an old beauty that's almost made as a pinnacle of the time it was made in. That needs cherishing. And looking at almost what we were talking about before, this is of a period and it's not going to be made again, so let's look after it.
Mm. Yeah. But maybe there's something, again, going back to the sentence, that it's in the making process, that relationship between object and subject gets really confused or blurred, that I think it's... Well, there's a particular kind of immersion sometimes, isn't there, in the process of making, where relationship to material, whatever that material is it's got the capacity maybe to collapse some of those definitions, perhaps. I don't know, maybe that's a romantic way of thinking about making, I'm not sure.
I think it is, but I think it's fair to make it. I mean, it's hard to be cold about all your work and emotionally invested in it. Cause if you weren't emotionally invested in your work, then would it have any meaning anyway? Would it be just stuff? I like the word stuff, but stuff in a bad way. You know, just things, nothingness. So
we're all artists. We all make.
Yeah. Design.
Design, but yeah, make.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. It's the thing that not many people do make anymore.
No, but it seems
I spend too much time for the computer and I don't make much.
Mm. Maybe that, again, is still a dialogue with the material, it's a process.
It's still a medium.
Because there's a point sometimes I think about the computer and the way that some people talk about the sense that the computer, if it's functioning efficiently, it just becomes an extension of your own body, that it's just, you know, you can do it. But is that kind of colonising the object in that respect?
I think so, yeah. I think it's like, I don't know, I've never had that. Maybe I'm negative, but I've never had that relationship with anything. Some people talk about drawing down the other, like, oh, flowing out of that kind of thing.
Well, no,
it feels like a battle. It feels like sometimes it's great, and it happens, but I have to battle to get there. And then we get to a point where it's comfortable, and then I kind of have a bit of fun with it and go, oh yeah, I know what I'm doing now, it's great. This is my little area that I've made to play in. But I have to like really fight to get to that area, you know, that point where, it gets to that point where it's all the things are built, and then that almost, that fun bit almost flourishes, yeah.
I mean, there's other things that are not, I mean, I think of driving, you know, is that kind of moment where it's something to do with the relationship of the human to the object, that they're making
this
happen. What is driving in terms of a process? Where is it located between the object and the subject? And there's probably other models like that in a way. Well, I suppose that's the kind of the idea of the cyborg in some respects, perhaps. But I don't know that...
Yeah. Second nature kind of thing,
well, there's a point where the car, or the appendage, whatever it would be, behaves in a way that you can't separate it from the limits of you. I mean, I can't do that because I don't never have the experience of driving. But there's a moment where, as some people would say, the car becomes just an extension of the body and that enables you to increase your capacity to do something, move with
velocity. Oh, okay, it's almost like a trophy, like, I think Matthew Barney did a drawing piece where he had like an arm extension, and was drawing with it, and that kind of thing. Yeah, cyborg, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose in that example, in terms of Matthew Barney, is the object, is the art, is the appendage object or subject?
That's slippage, isn't it?
It wouldn't exist, that thing wouldn't exist, it was made without that extension, that bolted onto him.
Then that wouldn't be animated.
Yeah, it's just a static.
Yeah, not to make it work.
Yeah.
But the make might have a power. Even though it doesn't produce anything without him in it.
There's the thing, yesterday I was doing this reading group in Sheffield about affect. And we were reading a text by Alison Lansbury, it was about prosthetic memories actually, and we're just thinking about that now, in terms of the nature of the prosthetic object. And she tells a story of a film, and it's like a really early film where there's a prosthetic arm that's found, and a guy finds this prosthetic arm and he gives it to a beggar who's not got an arm, and the beggar puts it on, and it turns out that the arm has got thieving intentions, so it turns him into a thief.
Oh, weird.
Sounds like League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, so he steals it, and then he kind of repents and he gets rid of the arm, and then the police come and find him and take him to prison, and in prison the arm re-identifies itself with it's the thief that's in there. Yeah, it's a bit like that. But it's almost like that sense of the appendage activates the body, you know, the object. Again, maybe this is this sort of possession thing again. No, it's the object, it's the appendage.
It's in the end, it reminds me of the Gogol. It's a Gogol story. It's about the nose. It's about a guy who wakes up one day and his nose is gone. And it's almost about humanising this piece of him. You know, it's like a person. It's just, he's walking around embarrassed. And, you know, have you seen my nose? I'm not sure where it's gone. And then he finds out it's gone somewhere, like down the pub or something. It's sort of, you know, that sort of surreal motion. And it does, yeah, it makes you think in a totally different way about objects and things.
Well, yes, and all of those bits of the things that fall off the body, are they objects? And what are they? Like, kind of that category sort of shift, I think, is really interesting. Sort of, the severed finger or the...
Yeah, what does it become when it's not longer attached? Is it still part of you? It's your finger.
There was a lady, was it in our last discussion? That one in
here? Oh, yes, that was amazing, wasn't it?
She kept a piece of her baby's umbilical cord.
Her umbilical cord, yeah.
So, we talked about baby teeth as well, and keeping those. Yeah, it's like if you found your own baby teeth, would that repulse you all? Obviously, they've got a different meaning for her.
Yeah.
That is a strange one.
And again, who does
the umbilical cord belong to? Weird, it's intermediary anyway.
That's amazing,
that one. That was...
If I take
anything away from today,
it would
be that image.
It's
incredible.
Yeah.
She said it is the size of a scar.
Yeah.
It wasn't like...
Oh!
It wasn't
like...
I kind of like the idea of that concept of an umbilical cord, because it is like that's two.
It's neither the mother nor the baby. Join her anyway. I'm really sorry that my mother didn't belong to a generation to keep ours.
But also, whether you'd say that the umbilical cord necessarily belongs to the mother because the baby is...
Well, that's what it is, ours. It's both, isn't it?
I'm quite interested in some of these
sort of
intermediary positions that are neither one or the other.
That's the weird thing with those things as well. Like, some people do keep them, or some people bury them, think weird things like that, or they just throw it away, aren't they?
Usually just throw it, aren't they?
But it feels like it's almost there, though.
Yeah, I think we're done.
Well, that's fine, I think.
Yeah.
I think we're all flabby.
I wish I'd put some earlier, you know, I think, which one to say, really, so it's kind of...
Well, I think we're supposed to end at 5:30 anyway.
Are we?
5:45, okay. Yeah. Well... I think we're allowed to be.
Have
you got your paper?
I forgot to make the notes.
Oh, you didn't make any. Oh, you bad girl.
No.
You like participated, anyway. Oh, it's all taped. I mean, yeah. My God.
There's something kind of quite curious about an event that's to do with attending to the sound of objects, so much vocabulary generated, I think, as well. I find that quite paradoxical in some sense.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been quite in our heads, really. I think we should all have to pick up an object in this room. I mean, we could have done something more practical.
Well, I just think, you know, like how present the chairs are, particularly when people aren't here.
They do start
becoming things in a way that they're not when they're being utilised. And I just kind of think, well, actually, you know, like some of the groups, you just can't get a word in because everyone's talking over to one another. And you just think, what are the chairs saying? You know, what are they saying?
Okay, I've been in quite small groups.
Some of them are quite hard, I think, in the group.
You've got agendas, haven't you, I guess? And
Thank you.
How do you spell the word? Are you talking about when I first came in the thinking set?
C-A-I-L-L-O-I-S. It was the text, Legendary Psychesthesia. It's got, I think it's called Insect Mimicry and Legendary Psychesthesia.
Oh, the sick insect mimicry.
Yeah. I've also written a lot about rocks, but I can't recall exactly the way that he talks about them. I think it's something to do with that interest in the object as having a kind of a force of some sort, or a call, I think, the call of the object.
I liked a piece of wood for a boomerang because I bodied with something that,
it's a really nice, text. Rosalind Krauss writes, I think she's written quite a lot in relation to it as well, about a number of surrealist practices. Where there's this, I suppose it's the relationship between figure and ground, actually,
right.
Which again maybe is that hinge of object-subject, I'm not sure. I think stick insects are quite fascinating in their mind.
Yes.
But they know what they are, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Probably.
Because there's other ones, isn't there, insects that pretend, is there something that they pretend to be dead in order not to be eaten, and there's others that when they're dead they look as if they're moving. Is there something like something pretends to be dead? There's a whole set of really weird convolutions where, I can't remember the ins and outs of it, but it's this relationship between animate and inanimate that just gets really weirdly knocked out of sync somehow. There's certain butterflies that pretend to be, look as if they're pretending to be leaves as a way of disguising themselves from predators. And he says this is completely untrue because the leaves get eaten much more readily. So they pretend to be something.
You mean it's not a very useful bit of camouflage?
It's like shooting yourself in the foot.
Oh well, we're getting ready for the next session.